this whole adulting thing comes with so many responsibilities.
Laundry.
A job.
And especially all that banking stuff.
Ugh.
Check out Westcom Credit Union. We're a member-owned not-for-profit, so you get low interest rates on credit cards and auto loans, plus access to 30,000 fee-free ATMs. And you can even do your banking online.
That sure makes the money part of adulting easy.
Westcom. The best bank for you may not be a bank at all. Westcom.org. Federally insured by NCUA. Certain terms may apply.
2 years
ago, Blog
Talk Radio.
Vous écoute. Vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon. You tell me.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. My guest tonight, addiction treatment specialist Dr. Stanton Peel, author of Recover, Stop Thinking Like an Addict, and Reclaim Your Life with the Perfect Program, smashes the myth that addiction is a disease, a biological force over which you have no control. Peel explains what few people realize, that 12-step programs are not based in science and have a very high relapse rate and actually take away people's self-determination. Peel writes in his book, if you believe taking one drink is identical to having 100 drinks and that you've got a progressive disease, it makes you powerless to control yourself. You won't just hop off the wagon, you will swan dive off it. But there is hope. On tonight's show, Peel will lay out how people can overcome addictions and gain control over their lives through values, learning how to feel their feelings instead of ducking them, and embracing who they are and who they want to be. Hello, Stanton.
Hello, Amy. How good to meet with you on your show.
Again, you're a repeat guest because I really appreciate the science-based approach you take to addiction. It really dispels a lot of the myths that so many people believe that are very damaging.
And I appreciate how you reach out to a broad audience and try and combine real evidence and real solid thinking and science with practical applications, because often those two worlds are totally
foreign, right. They're foreign to each other. And you do that, and I appreciate that in your work, Since Love and Addiction, which I read a long time ago and still have a very old copy of. So let's talk about the two competing views of addiction out there. The one we're used to hearing, which is that addiction is a disease, meaning that it's this biological force over which a person has no control. So tell us a little bit about that. Stanton, can you hear me? Did you disappear? Hello? Stanton, oh, you're calling back. Uh-oh, we lost you. Okay, I'm re-answering Stanton's call. Stanton, you disappeared. I was wondering if you were napping.
I know. I'm sitting here and the computer's in front of me.
Okay, well, I don't have to give you the background in this question because you know it. I wanted to know, you to tell us about this view that addiction is a disease, this biological force over which a person has no control.
If we look in the history of human habits, we've always had addictions, and people didn't think of them as medical diseases that were biologically imprinted and never could be overcome. And the reason they didn't think that is because they're not. Let me just give everybody a practical experiment that they can do. If you go out for dinner some night, you might ask people what the hardest drug addiction to quit is. I do this in front of large audiences, by the way, of recovering alcoholics and drug addicts. They always say smoking. And then I say to them, and you might say to your dinner companions, oh, has anybody here been addicted to cigarettes and quit? And I've been in rooms of 500 people where 300 people have raised their hands. And then I say to them, how many of you joined a support group or use a medical therapy, like Nicorette's to quit smoking, and at most a handful of people will raise their hands? What does this tell you? We know from our own lives that people who have the severest addictions overcome those addictions. If we look back at all the people we knew in college who were potheads and drank themselves crazy night after night during the week, and now we look at them as kind of responsible parents, we see this taking place. Somehow, when we take it away from our personal experience and place it in the world of medicine, encouraged, unfortunately, by people who are called experts, we're told nothing could be farther from the truth than what we know to be the truth, than what we experience in our own lives. And then they sell us a bill of goods that is actually counterproductive and unhelpful. If you have a child who has a problem, you know, if he stutters or he bites his nails, you don't tell him, you know, you have a disease that you can never overcome. You don't tell them that they're biologically doomed for the rest of their lives. Yet somehow that strikes people as a worthwhile thing to impart when we talk about addiction. But
now,
we know the best therapy techniques are the opposite of that. They're empowering.
Yeah, we'll get into that. I just wanted to break down, too, because there are these two competing views. So you went through the view that addiction is a disease which is not supported by scientific evidence, and the view that the scientific evidence supports. And I do want to say, people will refuse to believe this. You know, you could have the finest math brain and study assessor and epidemiologist in the world read these studies, and people will believe what they want to believe. But the view which the science does support, and the one you, Stanton, find most helpful, is that addiction is a natural but destructive expression of a person's outlook in reaction to his or her life circumstances.
We have a large number of national surveys. We have a large number of longitudinal studies. All of them show us the same thing, that a large percentage, the solid majority of people who are classified as being addicted to alcohol or drugs, overcome that experience. They do so ultimately permanently, and in most cases, they don't rely on treatment. There is no evidence to contradict this. I refer often to a massive study called NESARC, which was conducted by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. It's a government agency. They interviewed 43,000 Americans. Of everybody who's ever been alcohol dependent, three-quarters are now stably in remission, stably recovered. Only 12% of them have ever been to AA or alcohol rehab. And the majority of these people in stable recovery still actually drink.
I just want to stop you about the people drinking. That's just such a remarkable thing that you get into, where this abstinence culture that you must abstain, you must give up drinking, where we don't give up food if we have a food addiction, that is such a striking difference.
Well, of course, one of the things that's happened is as we broaden the conception of addiction, the abstinence rule, of course, makes no sense. What if we're really addicted to food? What if we're addicted to shopping? What if we're addicted to sex? How do we actually abstain from these things? So the whole paradigm, although all these things have been thrown into the disease category, it makes no sense. And it makes no sense really in terms of our own experience and in terms of what we know and what the research tells us about alcohol and drugs. People, as you said earlier, people become addicted to an experience at a place in their lives. And that place in their lives can be highly stressful. They can be, you know, at a crossroads. They can be without proper personal resources to deal with the demands on them. They may be hopeless. But those periods change in human lives, and people's susceptibility to addiction also changes. The best example of that, which we've forgotten a million times over, of course, was the Vietnam War, which I wrote about way back in Love and Addiction, 1975. We had tremendous addiction problems in Vietnam. When soldiers came home, voluntarily, 92% of them remitted from their heroin addictions. They rarely received treatment. And when you think, if you didn't know anything about the disease of addiction, if you talk to your grandmother, if she's still around, and you said, you know, guys in Vietnam, there was a lot of heroin available. They were really in a horrible war that wasn't supported at home. They weren't in control of their lives. A lot of them became addicted to a powerful painkiller. But you know, those same men, when they returned to the United States, seemingly had no need for that addictive sustenance. I can't possibly imagine why that's so. Anybody with any common sense would say, when your situation changes so radically, when you get so much more control over your life, when you have so much more to live for, it's obvious that you don't need that addictive experience the way you once did. And my books, including Recover, Stop Thinking Like an Addict, are about how to hasten that process in your own life to stop thinking about yourself as a shell-shocked soldier in a foreign country in a war, and to revert that thinking to understanding yourself as a positive human being who can progress in life, and for whom the world, if not their oyster, is something that you can mindfully get a hold of, control, and master.
And now I want to talk a little bit about how somebody gets into an addiction. And in your book, Recover, you tell the story of Rose, an addict. So talk about what caused her addiction and what did she get from it? That's a very interesting question. You bring that up in the book because people are using these drugs for a reason and not just
That's
to get high.
I mean, yes. I mean, two things I discount, and Rose is one example of that. People, when you believe there's a disease and addiction's a disease, you say to yourself, oh, it makes no sense why they're addicted. They just got addicted because of their biology or their genes. But in fact, every addiction has an internal logic to it. And when I do treatment, and, you know, I have a life process program that was part, I had a residential rehab program, and now it's online. The first thing you need to reflect on is how that addiction is a key into your life, what it serves a purpose for you to in your existence. The second myth about addiction, which I hate worse than the first, because people tend to say, oh, I agree with you. People just become addicted because their drugs are pleasurable. People don't become addicted to drugs for pleasure purposes. The guys in Vietnam weren't having fun when they were taking that heroin out of fear of life and death. People don't get aren't happy when they're repeatedly intoxicated or when they smoke two packs of cigarettes a day. People use addictions for the purpose of assuaging negative feelings about themselves and about their lives. And the story, we begin with the story of Rose, who's a normal-seeming person, a mother of a child, a single mother, who started using amphetamines because she was always behind the eight ball. She's trying to get ahead in work. She's trying to make money. She's trying to go back to school. It's not an unusual description of a life. And she started using meth or crank for the purpose of giving herself a boost. It seemed like a logical kind of assistance, but she came to depend on it as her whole existence. And at that point, she wasn't a happy person. She gave her child away to her own mother. It wasn't a permanent adoption. But here is a person driven to such an extent by her own discontent with herself, as much as anything, to allow her child to be out of her grasp, be out of her parenthood. And then I talk about what is most common, which is missing from virtually every addiction story that you'll read. There's a natural curative force in all of us. It's usually centered around some key crucial value that we hold. And the fact of her allowing her mother to have custody of her daughter caused her to reflect on exactly
breaking up
where
a little bit.
Life
was. Yeah, so you did.
I'm sorry?
Stanton, are you there? You broke up a little bit. Just repeat just that last little bit.
By giving away her daughter to her own mother in this case, she actually was forced to confront, as people often are, their most essential values. And recovery is partly about making that discovery for yourself before you reach such dire circumstances. But it caused a redemptive process in her, where she realized that she had to quit the meth, she did, which people quit every type of drug. You can't be intimidated by whatever your addiction is. Smoking is the hardest addiction to quit. People quit it all the time. She began to go back to school. She moved back with her parents. She reinvigorated her relationship with her family. She became a mother again. And her life bloomed because she was a capable person, a committed person. She only had to realize her better self. And that better self is there within all of us, sometimes disguised even from ourselves by the addiction. But here's the critical thing that we're saying. I wrote Recover with a woman named Ilsa Thompson. That discovery is not helped by being told that you have some inbred deficiency, either a biological disease or AA is telling you you've been led by your own selfishness. AA is a put-down routine. Instead, you need to discover the positive self parts of yourself and expand those parts to be all as encompassing as possible. And all of us have those positive experiences. All of us have had successes. All of us have positive values that can drive us in a good direction. And we shouldn't be discouraged about the fact that we've been slightly sidetracked, maybe even waylaid, but we should refocus on those things as the best way to get out of addiction.
Stanton, we're going to get back to Rose, but first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. Tonight, I'm talking with addiction treatment specialist Dr. Stanton Peel, and his book we're discussing is Recover, Stop Thinking Like an Addict, and Reclaim Your Life with the Perfect Program, which is a program of Stanton's. So back to Rose, you say that she began to see the positive results of her changed life. She began to savor being clean. And then she went to AA, heard she was powerless over her addiction after she quit meth. This was so damaging. And that what worked better for her was going to a psychologist, leaving AA, going to a psychologist who worked on her self-esteem, built her mothering and other skills. So she was building her up, as you say, it's not the put-down machine of AA. Stanton, are you there? Stanton, uh-oh. I hope he hasn't dropped off. Greg, can you check on Stanton? Maybe he can't hear or we can't hear him. I'll just say that I think seeing that your life can have meaning is perhaps a big part of this, Stanton's very values-oriented approach. I write in Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck, which is my next book, or my new book that's out, about psychiatrist Viktor Frankl's thoughts on meaning, that you can have it in your life, not by chasing happiness, but by being about more than yourself, by caring about the world outside yourself. One suicidal guy in the concentration camp saw his daughter as something to live for, so he saw himself as needed. That's very important. Oh, it looks like Stanton's calling back. Okay, Stanton, are you there?
One of the things AA is, people get saved by AA, God bless them. Its overall success rate is remarkably low, and it's not surprising how unsuccessful it is and why many people reject it and don't find it a place they want to go from the start, Rose being one of them. To be told that you're powerless, to be making a list of your sins, so to speak, to be seeking forgiveness all of the time. The whole thing is such an added weight on you. And Rose went to a 12-step program after she'd already quit meth because everybody thinks, well, this is the right thing to do. I mean, isn't this how you get over it? And she had the self-delusion, which quite a few people do, to realize that that wasn't a good environment for her. She went to a psychologist, as you described, doing some normal self-work, cognitive behavior therapy, making positive statements about yourself, reviewing skills that you already have. She joined a group, of single mothers, where instead of when you go to an AA, and I described that process, when you go to AA, you're really loaded down with all the bads that you've done. When she went to the parents group, and she guiltily described how she had a big meth habit, she quit it, she regained her child, they cheered her. And later recognize how strong and how positive she had been, which is such a normal reaction, actually, and it's so much of a better reaction. But think about how when you're in AA, you're spending all the time reviewing all the things you've done wrong in life. It's such a bad orientation. We know that in psychology. We know that people have to, and in mindfulness, positively visualize themselves and the directions that they want to go in, reclaim their strength, and reimagine themselves based on those assets, those resources, those skills, those values that they already possess and that they can find demonstrated throughout their lives.
Now, Stanton, I want to ask you about the low success rate of AA, and I want to say there's something that we have called confirmation bias, where we want to believe the things we already believe. We want information that confirms that, and we ignore information that doesn't. I have a blog commenter who, under the posting about this show, he quotes me. I said, "Most people recover from addictions on their own without AA or rehab, and what makes the difference is values, not biology." I'm talking about your work, of course. And he says, "Despite the shady qualifications of its wordings, that's as loathsome as it is absurd." But that really is true. And I wanted to tee that up as a way for you to talk about what people really don't know, how low the success rate of AA is. I think I read that only 12% of people stay off their addiction.
Well, hey, you know, when we discovered antibiotics, we were able to cure pneumonia. I always ask people, AA was invented, was discovered in 35, in the big book in 1939. I like to ask people, how well have we been doing with addiction since then? Do you think that there are fewer alcoholics or a lower rate of alcoholism or drinking problems or drug addictions or of other addictions since AA was discovered or since AA became prevalent in the 70s or 80s? Nobody believes that. It's as though it's the emperor who has no clothes. We say, oh, what a great solution we have for addiction. Isn't it wonderful? And more people are going to AA. If only even more people would go, we'd have even better results. That cultural meme cannot be extinguished. It's as your writer can write in, I can say, well, what about Nisar? What about the number of people who quit smoking? Aren't you impressed by that? But there's this need, this belief, this thing that they feel sounds scientific to say, well, addiction is a progressive disease. I don't know about those smokers, and I don't know about those college drinkers, and I don't know about that research showing most alcoholics and drug addicts overcome addictions. I know this thing that's in my mind and that's in this culture. And by the way, AA is not the only disease theory I'm at pains to refute. I know you've interviewed Sally Satel, a good friend of mine. Her quote is on the cover of my book. In 1978, we first discovered the first endogenous peptides in the brain, endorphins. And I love to quote all the great claims made for that. We will soon overcome mental illness. We will soon overcome addiction. And in fact, beginning in 1980, we've had a surge in virtually every identifiable form of mental illness or emotional disorder, ADHD, bipolar, depression, schizophrenia, addiction, autism even. How is it that every time we announce that we're just on the verge of solving our addictions and mental illness problems, they shoot upwards? And as I say in the book, there, in the terms of neuroscience, there's not a single diagnostic tool or treatment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Stanton, you're breaking up a little bit. Can you repeat that?
There's not a single tool for diagnosing or treating addiction based on neuroscience. Let me just give you an illustration. Nobody goes to the Betty Ford Center and they do a brain scan and they say you're addicted. They say you're addicted when people ask you, well, how much cocaine were you taking? How is it affecting your life? Have you been in jail? Have you been thrown out of your house? Have you had traffic accidents? Are you in physical duress? It's all about your life space. There's nothing that can be measured, as Sally Satel said on your program, in a brain scan that can give you that kind of information. Addiction is, as the best scientific way of describing it, is a failure of living your own life in your own skin and being able to secure your happiness. There are two major qualifications for something being included in DSM-5, the Diagnostic Manual, and that those two things are distress. Are you unhappy in your own skin? And the inability to function, impairment. Are you not able to fulfill your requirements of your life? Those are the signs of mental illness. They can't be detected in an MRI. I just want to mention one ironic thing. If any of your listeners are inclined to discount my ideas and to say, well, I wonder what his qualifications are. As you know, Amy, in 1975, I wrote Love and Addiction with Archie Brodsky. And we said that addiction is not a function of drugs. It's not a chemical side effect of the biology of drugs. It's a way people have of relating to experience. In 2013, the American Psychiatric Association released its latest version of its Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, DSM-5. For the first time, they recognized non-drug experiences as addictive. They recognize only one, it so happens, gambling, but they've opened the floodgates. There'll be sex, there'll be love, there'll be video games, there'll be shopping. Everything can be addictive or cannot be addictive. And, you know, in all modesty, and I know the person that wrote into your website will be among the first to agree with me, I believe that Archie and I are in line for the Nobel Prize because 40 years ago we have said what American psychiatry has only just now come to recognize. So, in all modesty, I want your listeners to be aware that my sense of addiction, what it is in relation to human beings, how it takes place in the world, how people overcome it, I've been pretty prescient about it up till now, and I plan on continuing to do so.
I want to actually quote you because you mentioned experience. I'll quote both you and Fred Wolverton, who is another addiction treatment specialist I respect, and it's a short list, believe me. So you say in 7 Tools to Beat Addiction, when people turn to an experience, any experience for solace to the exclusion of meaningful involvements in the rest of their lives, they are engaged in addiction. And then Fred Wolverton in Unhooked explains that what all addictions have in common is a longing to avoid legitimate suffering, difficult emotions that are a normal part of being alive. And this is this values bent of your work that I think is so important that you saw, we see when you told us about Rose, who overcame that addiction. And what the people who want to medicalize addiction do, they know that most people in the public do not understand anything about these brain imaging studies. They just see pretty pictures of the brain. We have Nora Volko from the government saying it's all about the dopamine, as if it's that simple, and it's not. And you write about Joseph Ledoux, who's a neuroscientist I respect, and he and many other neuroscientists say that it is impossible to map out specific human experiences onto designated places in the brain. It's not like a cartoon where there's like, you know, Simpsons, there's one little area mapped out for, you know, like the video game area. Here's the living room, you know. So just tell us a little bit about that, how duped people are.
One of the things, you know, people say, well, Stan Geo and Sally Satel are anti-scientific, but the better steeped in neuroscience and aware a scientist is, the more likely they are to agree with us. The more aware you are, the levels of analysis, the way that a brain image is so disparate from an experience that a human being has and how they eventually act out that feeling, how they express whatever urges they have, nobody understands that better than real neuroscientists. Let me just tell you one little story. I would never testify at a trial for a tobacco smoker. But I sometimes review those kinds of materials because people ask my opinion about them. One man sued a tobacco, he had died, and his daughter sued the tobacco company. But ironically, he had quit smoking 10 years earlier. And he had smoked for 40 years. He had smoked since he was a teenager. He had had a heart attack. This was 10 years before he actually died. And he woke out of his coma, his medical coma, and he said to his daughter, "Get me a cigarette, heart, darling." And his daughter said to him, "I'll get it for you, Dad, but then I'll never speak to you again." And he quit smoking. Now, I'd like people to explain in strict neuroscience terms how that happened. And, of course, it can't be explained. And there's nothing more scientific than values and purpose in life. And that really gets back to the other quote that you gave. People, when you get over an addiction, you're not guaranteeing that you're entering heaven or a land of perfect experience. You're learning to accept the imperfections of life. And the reason you accept the imperfections of life with its pain and its duress is because you have more important values and more and a purpose in life. It's not eliminating negative feelings, which none of us can ever do, although we can certainly try and minimize some of the worst. It's about having a reason to live, a purpose that you want to accomplish, a way forward, a set of goals before you. And let me just put that in. If we talk about, I have another book called Addiction Proof Your Child. There's no better guarantee that your child will be able to endure what is turning out to be an increasingly addiction-prone world, where new addictive substances are invented all the time. Look at the pharmaceutical painkillers. Then that child feeling they have a purpose in life, something that means something to them, and being confident that they're worthwhile and that they have the abilities to pursue something worthwhile. You can't eliminate addiction by saying, you know what, I'm going to tell my kid never to have a drink or smoke marijuana or take a painkiller for the rest of their lives. That's the AA method, by the way. And let me just cite somebody. I happen to live in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and I go to the Y with the mayor, Mayor de Blasio, whose daughter has a viral video. She's 19 years old. She's in recovery, and I think that means she's planning on never having a drink or smoking marijuana. Those were her problems. She also had she was depressed for the rest of her life. Suppose she lives to be 89. She's never going to have a drink or take any drug for the next 70 years. That's her therapeutic plan. That's a therapeutic plan that's doomed to failure. Now, when I actually had the goal to go up to the mayor, and I'll point out that there was a neat recent article in the New York Times pointing out my work and the Center for Motivation and Change. It was written by a great writer named Gabrielle Glasser, where she is beginning to announce, just as I pointed out in Love and Addiction, that addiction is not limited to drugs. I've always said that we've overrated the disease model in AA. It doesn't produce large cultural benefits. It barely ever works for individuals. And she announced in the New York Times that there's become a growing awareness of the limitations of the disease model of abstinence only of AA, and that new people are staking out new directions. I was one of them, and the Center for Motivation and Change was another. So what could I do? I went up to the mayor, and I said, "Oh, Mr. de Blasio, did you happen to see the article in the Times, it was on July 3rd, about alternatives to AA and to 12 steps?" And he said he missed it. And then I said, "You really might want to take a look at it." I didn't mention his daughter. It could be a sensitive topic. But telling people, just don't do it. Just say no, a la Nancy Reagan. It's not treatment. It's not prevention. And it's not successful.
You know, in the prevention line, I want to talk a little bit about my childhood. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Stanton Peel, addiction treatment specialist, very science-based. His book we're discussing is Recover, Stop thinking like an addict and reclaim your life with the perfect program. Very values-based. I really love that about your work because it's really, really important. And this is what happened to me as a child. I grew up, I'm an atheist now, but I grew up Jewish, and so Jews always have this terrible Menashevitz wine, and my dad drank schnapps and stuff like that. And he would always offer us something. We could have wine on Sabbath, and he'd give us some taste of whatever he was drinking. And drinking was no big deal. And, in fact, when I wanted to see what it was like to get drunk, I did it with my parents. We went to a wedding because it wasn't forbidden. And I was so unexcited by alcohol when I went to college. I drank once, and I drank too much, and I just didn't drink again until I was, like, in my late 20s. And I think that that's an example of this demythologizing and deforbidding. I don't think that's a word, but when you're not forbid something, it's not that exciting.
We know where people were brought up in abstinence households are the people that are most prone to become overwhelmed by alcohol and drugs when they're exposed to them. As in those cases that you read about where a kid goes to college, he's never had a drink, and they go to a fraternity hazing party, and they end up sometimes comatose and sometimes dead. Remember, as late as we are in the United States, 21 years, our drinking age is 21 years of age. Do you know what the drinking age is in Italy and Spain, Amy?
I know that 14-year-olds drink when there's some kind of family event.
Right. It's 16 is the legal drinking age, but people, really, there's no drinking age. If you go to a restaurant in Italy or Spain, they'll give a child wine. They're so different from us and the Northern Europeans. In Finland, if you ask somebody, when did you first drink, they said, I was 15 or 16. It was during the summer solstice. I spent all night drinking, and I puked, and I became completely inebriated. If you ask an Italian when they first started drinking, they can't answer that question. They say, well, why don't you ask me when I first started eating pasta? There are two whole different models of dealing with that experience. And unfortunately, the American-based, AA-supported neuroscience disease model says drugs will take control of you. You can never sample them even once. And the problem is, of course, people sample these things. They certainly sample alcohol. 90% of people in America will drink at some point. Majority of them will sample marijuana. A majority of them will take even powerful painkillers. And by the way, listeners should know that synthetic narcotic painkillers are more powerful than heroin. Your listeners should know, as Carl Hart says, the drug that's active in amphetamines is exactly the same drug that is present in Adderall, and drugs that are given to kids all the time to deal with ADHD. All of these substances aren't magical monsters that can take control of you. And you need to know that, and the reason you need to know that, and the reason your children need to know that, is you cannot get through a life without being exposed to not only these powerful chemical experiences, but remember, American psychiatry has just followed my lead 40 years later and recognized that there are things that are not drugs that are just as addictive. And if you get, and if you drive the subway in New York, you see people completely engrossed in these video games, which has to be as among the most addictive experiences known to human beings, because they're all encompassing. They absorb your total awareness. People cannot get through this earth, children less so all the time, without being exposed to powerful, overwhelming sometimes experiences, including love and sex, where they have to have the personal resources and the belief in themselves to come to grips with, to manage, to overcome negative experiences, or you're just not going to be able to proceed through your time on Earth here.
Now, you mentioned AA again, and I wanted to get into this myth because people really believe this one, that recovering from addiction requires hitting bottom. Does it?
I write about that. Nilsen, I write about that. You know, three major myths about addiction, abstinence being one of them. Of course, AA has a sliding scale. If you come in and you say, well, I don't have that bad a drinking problem, of course they'll say, well, your head is in that direction. you're now at this point and you're going to get worse. That's not a very healthy message, do you think? To tell people that if they haven't quit yet, it's because they haven't hit bottom, their lives are going to get even worse than that. That turns out to be, don't you think, quite a sliding scale. And as we point out and recover, a better way to conceptualize it is to say, what is the worst thing about this experience for me now, so that I don't have to in AA or hit bottom. Just really, what's hitting bottom? Dying is hitting bottom. Any other experience can be worse than that. You have to reconceptualize what you've already endured, and what you dislike about that is something you don't want to re-enter, as something you don't want to re-experience. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy that's also totally illogical to tell people, well, you're only going to get, and it's, by the way, untrue, that you have to get as bad as you can possibly get before you can get better. Most people don't descend to those levels. They start improving, and it's almost as though they disappointed AA by failing to hit bottom, ending up in the streets and dying, like, you know, going to an institution, dying, or ending up in prison like they're always telling you you're about to do.
Exactly.
It also seems a license to do really terrible things, because it's sort of like, well, come back when you've hit bottom. I mean, that seems a bad idea. And you mentioned in relation to the Vietnam vets who came back, they used heroin when they were over there. Understandably, they don't want to be there while they're there. And you write, too, about people maturing out of addiction. Maya Selovitz compared the addict's brain to a teenager's brain. And you point out that people, when they have something that matters to them, something they have to do, like Rose, who needed to care for her daughter and be a proper mother to her, that this gives them something meaningful where it's more important than their escape.
Well, let's talk about Maya, and let's talk about mindfulness. I'm sure you'll eventually interview Maya. Maya is somebody who talks about her own heroin addiction, by the way, which she came to late in life, and she went to Hazelden. I knew Maya before she had decided that she was going to drink wine again. She's getting married this weekend, by the way.
Oh, that's great. I actually, I know her. I quoted her in Good Manners for Nice People, who sometimes say fuck.
She's a wonderful person, and I remember discussing with her when she was thinking about drinking wine again. And I said, you know, Maya, you're a pretty stable person now. I don't think of you as becoming an alcoholic. And she began drinking wine again. By the way, a well-known example that I love the way people put her down when I bring this up. Drew Barrymore, of course, was a 12-year-old America's youngest addict and alcoholic. She was in recovery. She's in her late 30s now. She's a famous Hollywood personage. She has started her own winery. Just married a Jewish guy, you know, where they break those wine glasses at the wedding. And whenever I write about it, people say, oh, she's in denial. Obviously, either you hit bottom, or if you don't hit bottom, you're in denial. It's so illogical, don't you think? And instead, she's the biggest successes you're going to find as a producer and as an actress. And the problem we have is when somebody like that undergoes that kind of an experience, they don't get, and that person who wrote in, you know, disparaging me in your show is an example of why, and the people who write into my blogs when I talk about Drew Barrymore, is it why she doesn't. When you outgrow addiction, like Drew Barrymore did, by growing up, by developing a stable view of yourself, by finding love, you don't want to talk about it. Isn't that ironic? Isn't that something that should be really happy and healthy? But you can't talk about it because you're going to be experiencing onslaught like that person that you mentioned writing in. You'll be vilified. That's how crazy these models are. You say, if Drew Barrymore were to get pure on television, say, you know, I grew up, I had some really bad family experiences. I found love in my life. I found that I had skills and gifts. I found that I enjoyed life. And now I can drink wine. It's just not a problem. I enjoy it as a pleasure of my existence. People will come down on her like a ton of bricks.
Well, I'm going to talk about me in relation to this next, but first, this is Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Stanton Peel, addiction treatment specialist, and his book we're discussing is Recover, Stop Thinking Like an Addict, and Reclaim Your Life with the Perfect Program. I just wanted to mention my own experience. I used to medicate with brownies, with carbohydrates, with just, you know, I would eat because it was sort of a food high and it was an escape. But I realized it wasn't solving my problems. It would make me feel sick, ashamed, and get a little fat. And so I stopped. The realization that I didn't solve an emotional problem with a brownie, I just made the emotional problem worse. I really didn't want to feel like an idiot anymore, and that's idiotic behavior. And so I stopped. And I don't, I didn't, nobody said you should. Right, nobody told me. Oh, sorry, I was going to say, nobody told me I had to quit food. You have to give up food forever. I just
and you
had
look
to...
at your life. You've now got a career. You've got a love partner. You get positive feedback for the human being you are. You keep in good shape. Your life has just hit a different kind of a inflection point, which should be celebrated. Everybody should understand how that happens, and it happens often. And instead, we're busy putting that down.
I just wanted to add, Stanton, just an example of this. Yesterday, I went to a friend's baby shower, and they had food out there, and I don't eat carbs, so I didn't have any carbs, even though the carbs look kind of good. And I don't eat dessert. I eat dessert about once a week. And they had cupcakes, and they had chocolate frosting. It looked kind of good. Little teeny cupcakes. I had one cupcake. I didn't have three cupcakes, four, five. I didn't have a cupcake and three cookies. I just had one. And it's so amazing that once you do what you're saying.
Possible? That is really hard. Forget controlled drinking. Controlled eating is the hardest thing of all, and you've mastered that. Because you grew up and you got a little bit better place, space psychologically. And really, there's no way out of that. If food and carbohydrates are your and sugar are your problems, you're just not going to be able to eliminate everything from your life. And, AA tells you if you sip alcohol in a rum cake, you're going to go on a 5-week bender. And it's sort of like, oh, my God, I didn't realize there was carbohydrate in what I ate. And, you know, it's hard to get all carbohydrates out of everything. Think of that. If that same model said, oh, I ate a carbohydrate, now I'm going to have to eat 10 cupcakes. That's the AA model expressed in food.
Right. It's
I want to mention mindfulness a little. I know
I know you're running. Okay, here, let me run the show. But, I did want to get to that next. But let me ask you about it. We talked about this on last week's show, and I've written about it in my column. In fact, that column I quoted you on. And just if you first can tell us, this is a form of meditation. And this is based in solid research, I know, because I've read all the research and you've read even more. So, but first, just tell us what mindfulness meditation is and why it helps with addiction.
Well, there are two meanings for mindfulness that I point out in Recover. Cognitive behavior therapy has often used the idea of mindfulness as a way of being able to be aware of your environment and what's important to you. And I just, before I go into mindfulness meditation, I just want to mention that in regards to things that we've already been talking about as a common sense link. If you, specifically about hitting bottom, if you have a child who's doing something wrong, you try and having negative outcomes, like they're being unpopular at school, you try and help them expand their awareness to see the link between their behavior and the consequences. That's the psychological, the CBT version of mindfulness. And you might say to the child, well, do you see that when you are really aggressive in the playground that people don't like that? You try to make them aware of it so that they don't hit bottom, so that they don't become completely isolated, so that they don't have increasing negative feedback. It's the opposite of hitting bottom. It's making you aware of your consequences and your impact in the world. So that's the traditional psychological view of it. Mindfulness meditation is a way of making you intensely aware of the here and now. And I know you write about being aware of and focusing on different parts of your body. Of course, traditional meditation has you focus on your breathing because it's ever present. And it's just remarkable how many things we do in life automatically without, in fact, focusing on them and being immersed in them and being immersed in light. Mindfulness meditation is a way of calming yourself sufficiently so that you can focus on the very basic functions and emotions that you experience. At Alan Marlatt's group, Alan Marlatt, of course, a great psychologist who unfortunately died in 2011, has been pioneering, and his group, the University of Washington, has shown positive addiction results, relapse prevention results with mindfulness meditation. And here's one of the techniques that they use. Think of when you have an addictive urge or a craving of that as a physical embodiment. One thing they talk about is seeing it as a wave, something that rises and falls, which is in fact true about cravings. And think of it as a physical manifestation in your mind, and imagine yourself as a surfer, or if that's a little too ambitious, imagine yourself body surfing that wave. And that urge to use can grow fairly intense, but you know it's going to come down again. And if you imagine yourself floating up with that urge and then riding it down as it decreases and declines, you're able to encapsulate that experience within your own controllable thought process. And that one of the main purposes that Ilse and I had in writing Recover is this. We have two big paradigms in our society. You've talked about the disease model, and we talk about CBT, but we have that whole other Marianne Williamson mindfulness model, where people have the ability to gain control of their urges and their emotions with their own minds and their own ability to direct their thinking. That's a big line of thinking in America. You know, positive thinking, that we have motivational lectures who tell us that all the time. And that's in one corner, and it's the exact opposite of the disease model, which says when that urge rises in you, you have no ability to withstand it. In your case, you have no ability to have only one half of a cupcake. You do have that ability. You can practice meditation and mindfulness control of your urges and of your thinking. You can practice self-control. There's a bestseller out by Baumeister and Tierney where self-control is something that's practicable. And all of the point of everything that we're saying here is a human being is an improvable object. You can make yourself and your life better. You know you can. People do it all the time. There are techniques that allow you to do those things. Why are we selling people a bill of goods that they're out of control mechanisms that have no chance of rectifying themselves once they've made a mistake? It's nonsensical, it's counterproductive, and it's a sin against humanity to try and sell that bill of goods to everybody.
It's so damaging, and I just wanted to explain a few things that I find in the mindfulness literature that are really helpful. That one of the things that you are describing is that basically you're taking out the judgmentalness from the equation. You're observing these urges and feelings in you. That's really important. And another thing, too, is that you slow down time. You're able to experience moments in a way we aren't in real life. You point this out in your book, Recover, that when we're in the moment, everything's going really fast, but you can feel your feelings and become less panic-stricken about them. And also another important thing is to be able to experience discomfort, and that's a big part you point out of when you're getting off a drug or a situation or a substance that you say that we're accustomed to whatever that thing is, and then we need to sort of get used to backing off that and the physical symptoms of that and the emotional and psychological symptoms.
Those are great points you bring up, and thank you for bringing them up, Amy. Mindfulness is a way of slowing time in a fashion. And, you know, people talk about meditating. Gosh, who knew there was so much time in the universe? I'm sitting here for 5 minutes, and it seems like an eternity. But that eternity can often be a point of choice points. When we're in the throes of an addiction, as you said, we feel like we have no choices, that we're being driven like the hound by the hounds of hell. But you do have the ability to slow down your decision making. And the great thing about mindfulness meditation, even if you do it for 1 minute, is that you can see the pacing of your life. You can realize the time stretches out.
Uh-oh, Stanton, did we lose you? Okay, you know you're still there. I thought we lost you.
I'm sorry.
You're thinking.
The time can be stretched out, and that you can master time in your own mind, that you can introduce a choice point where you fear that you have no choice. And you describe that really quite beautifully, that meditation is a way of grasping and getting control of time.
And I just wanted to add, you pointed out something that's very realistic, and this is what I really like about your work. I should say who I'm talking to. It's Dr. Stanton Peel, addictions treatment specialist, very science-based. His book we're discussing is Recover, Stop Thinking Like an Addict, and Reclaim Your Life with the Perfect Program. We have about 3 minutes left, but I just wanted to say about your realism. I had a guest on a couple weeks ago, Dr. Andrea Brandt, and she was talking about anger, and she talked about how positive mindfulness meditation is, and she made me realize can do this at the end of the day. Like you're saying, a minute. She said maybe 3 days a week, 3 minutes, a minute, 5 minutes. It really does help. And so you accept the realistic limitations of humans. We don't see ourselves, who wants to sit there for 20 minutes? You know, if you commit to that off the bat, that seems like a lot. But a minute after you're done with your workday, that's not that hard.
It's mindfulness and meditation are your tools and your servants. If you can sit up in bed, fold your legs before you rush off during the day, put your palms in your lap, and just try and clear your mind. And if you fail to clear your mind, that's fine. Try again. Do that for a couple of minutes, and you find, like everything else, practice makes perfect. And I'm really glad you brought up anger. It's often put in the same category with addiction. I'm uncontrollable. I can't control my anger. But I discuss an anger freak in the book, in Recover. If you really believe that, are you planning on beating people for the rest of your life? Are you planning on going to prison? We know that we have the ability to control these things. We know that people calm down as they get more mature. We know that as people reflect on the consequences of their actions, we know that if whether they meditate or simply introduce a little bit of a pause, maybe counting down from 10, that they can control many, all negative urges that drive people in these different directions. So there's really, and you're great, Amy, at finding people, the confluence of people, mindfulness meditations, anger management, overcoming addiction and eating problems. They're really all part of the same bailiwick of human experience, our ability to gain control of ourselves through reflection, self-management, practice, purpose, and awareness of our own power. That's the final thing I really need to tell people. We're not powerless. We are the greatest instrument of power in each of our own lives.
Actually, the final thing I'd like you to touch on is just compassion and self-compassion in this, along with self-acceptance, how important those things are in recovering from addiction.
Well, that is good. I mean, mindfulness is one key component in the addiction recovery process. There's another concept in Buddhism that we refer to called loving kindness. And loving kindness is a way of accepting first yourself, being compassionate toward yourself. Rose had to be compassionate towards the mistakes she's made. I imagine Drew Barrymore had to think, oh, well, I was a kid then. Look at the crazy things I did. We all have much to forgive ourselves for, and rather than going back and making a list of our sins, like in AA, thinking about and forgiving ourselves for what we've done that we've mismanaged in our lives is a critical element for being non-judgmental, because as you described with yourself, you're driven often to your addictions by the negative consequences of your last action. Oh, look how foolish I was when I drank. Look how sloppy I've gotten when I eat. These things then become feedback to make you feel worse about yourself. And so we devote a whole chapter. The perfect program P is pause, which we talked about, introducing a pause in your life. E is embrace. where you embrace yourself with your possible imperfections, but love yourself. And we talk about anorexia in that regard, where beautiful models are convinced that they're ugly. And then that expands to compassion for others. And we talk about there's a woman who wasn't able to forgive her mother and how necessary that became as a part of her overcoming her addiction. That you extend compassion from yourself, self-compassion, to compassion to other people, including strangers, but including to those we love and those who are close to us, who sometimes, you know, we're more intolerant than we need to be, and that that's an important part of the entire process of overcoming addiction and other emotional barriers in our lives.
Stanton, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I have been talking with Dr. Stanton Peel, addiction treatment specialist. His book we've been discussing is Recover, Stop Thinking Like an Addict, and Reclaim Your Life with the Perfect Program. Stanton, thank you so much.
Thank you for this intelligent, well-guided interview. Thanks for leading me in such a positive direction.
And I'll see you in Brooklyn for that hamburger.
I owe you one. See you soon.
See you soon.
You know the guy who knows people who know people who can get tickets to the playoffs? That's not me. Backstage passes at a concert? No idea how to get them.
At Westcom Credit Union, we give everyone special treatment with lower fees and great yields and perks like the latest banking apps and access to 30,000 fee-free ATMs. And anyone in SoCal can open an account.
Woohoo! I'm in.
Westcom, the best bank for you may not be a bank at all. Westcom.org. Federally insured by NCUA. Certain terms may apply.